KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Stay tuned for Technology Bites. You've just hit the holiday, the Technology Bites holiday party for 2014, and obviously this is a different voice to start the show than you usually get. Afflicted is he no here? He's flu bound, so send out your good thoughts to him. As
he's luked.
His email is virus free at least.
That's right.
And so, so sorry you don't get the usual non sequitur to start the show. I guess the other tough part is then how do you throw to yourself? Well, you don't. So I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And I'm Dwight.
So that
and
now you know.
So Groovehouse is missing too.
Yeah, we're down like three people today.
So the sad part is, I guess without flicking his laptop, we're not going to be able to Skype in your dog.
I think we're in. We're not in just missing geek formation. We're in like limping geek formation.
Well, I'll be your crutch, baby.
There you go.
That's right. Mr. Yeah, Silverman is back.
It's
back
good
in the
to
chair.
Have Dwight back.
I'm even back in my old chair, and it's. I have the right view. You know, I have the right point
true,
of view.
True. And actually, I had worried. I guess with the new board and that, it's actually kind of a better view than it used to have. You know, it used to be a little bit harder to see everybody. And talk because that's the only thing I was worried about with you know I'm on the board as you may have guessed.
That's why our levels are so messed up.
That's why we sound like a really bad '60s garage band in your headphones right now.
So we've moved firmly into the '80s with our board technology, our engineering board technology. Or because we were solid '70s. You know, maybe had seen a tour in South America and come back to our station.
Well, we moved from one that had wood accents on it to one that has metal accents, so I think that may be 80s.
That's futuristic.
There we go.
All right.
So, decade up.
And they, like, split off. You know, now there's sort of a board that's got all the master stuff, and then the, like, individual mics are often in separate, in a Mackie 14-channel mic line mixer.
You.
Sweet.
Just so we could sound, you know. Sort of.
Just
I don't
so
think
you can
we
say that.
Yeah, I don't think we intentionally upgraded. I think that our last board died and we had to replace it. It's not like we're just throwing cash everywhere at the station.
What? I thought they took it out to a radio station on a farm where it could
broadcast.
Where it was going to broadcast only indie vinyl from the original days of Pacifica. All right. Well, here's the info. You are listening to Technology Bites. The website is www.geekradio.com. There's cool stuff there. For instance, there's information on the Geek Gathering, which is at the beginning of January, but not obviously on the first Friday in January because of the Gregorian chant and leap years.
Because we know you know when it'll be in town. So.
Actually, yeah. It's because we're not going to have it on the 2nd of January. So it will be on the, it'll be 7 days later when everybody can actually be there. And the other thing I guess you should know early on, and we'll try to remember to repeat it later in the show, is the show is, we're not going to be preempted. We figured out that we're not going to be of high value on, oh, say, Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Christmas Eve, you've already bought your technology. You've already, you know, we're not going to be a big help.
We've done our time in Christmases past, too.
And New Year's Eve, well, we don't, none of us plan to be in a state to broadcast for New Year's Eve. So that leaves, so we're going to have, we have a special guest. Ray Hill is going to do some programming in that time.
We're going to prison.
I think we're going to be, yeah, we'll say that, you know, basically it's our Christmas present to the incarcerated is they won't hear us and they'll hear somebody who probably has a lot more to say to them than we do. And hopefully, I'm betting there'll be some more family type stuff for that. And I think that's not a bad move. But so you won't hear us the next couple weeks. We'll be back. We'll be back that same week that there's a Geek Gathering, so you'll hear us again before that.
And we can pester you about the Geek Gathering during that episode.
There you go. Yeah, we'll remind you. So, you know, just yeah, if you go on that on the 2nd, say hi to Con for us. I'm sure he'll be glad
he'll
to
be
see
there.
You,
yeah.
But he will be wondering why there aren't that many geeks.
We've also got the show within the show.
That's true. On the IRC, you can get to that from the website. Like I said, geekradio.com. That has the Krampus song on it. It has the announcement of the Geek Gathering, and there is a link to go to cuckoo.com. Oh,
cuckoo.
No groove.
Yeah, Groove House. Oh.
No sound effects. Jeez. So, cuckoo.com, and we're in channel pound Tech Bytes. And let's see what else. You know, you can call during the show. This is our virtual Christmas party. I think would be the way to put it. We had some eggnog off air. No, we don't have beverages. We don't have any illicit beverages in the studio, as far as anyone knows, or as far as anyone can tell. But no, we follow the rules. We're good about that here. Anyways. So this is our virtual Christmas party. We'll take your calls if you hear us. You know, while we're talking about the many varied subjects of the show, then you can call in and certainly contribute. And you can also let's see. I know what I need. I need some network because I was wondering why my. My setup for I have a reading list, and that's where I put the articles. We send around stuff before the show. It's a little insider thing. We send around some emails before the show and have some of the like articles and stuff we're going to talk about, and I keep those on a reading list. And of course, the nice part is when you go to the studio, I can crank open my laptop, and once it's on the network, I get my reading list, and then I know I've got all the articles, which sadly I'm not organized in advance of the show like I maybe would usually do, but you know, we're going to wing it.
By the way, I want to say, you know, it's been a while since I think I was in here last during one of the fundraisers, cause I'm that much of a masochist. And, and I got to say that the Wi-Fi, they have switched out the Wi-Fi here at the Mighty 90, and it is mighty indeed. The internet access is just like rocking my.
You're like 40 down, 20 up.
44 down, 20 up, which is
it's just like home.
Finally, finally, they are equal to our homes.
Right.
to geek homes, I guess would be the way to
put it. Most people like their work internet speeds. Are they faster than at home or slower than
at
home?
Depends on
these
where
days.
You work, I think.
Yeah, it's the same for me.
And
okay.
At my house.
So at the Chronicle, I think I get about 35 down. At home, I'm 120 or so.
Oh, wow.
So
there was a time when the fast access was at work, and you had faster machines at work, and you know, to get the good tech stuff, you had to be at work. But there's been a reversal, and now it seems like the older, slower machines are at work. slower connections are working. That's when you can connect to actually download stuff that you'd want to download.
Mm-hmm. I don't really have any complaints at work. You know, I spend all day working on the web, and I have, you know, moving from site to site, and it's fine. But it's definitely faster.
I'm glad we've got the good stuff at home now. That's what I'm arguing
well,
here.
Well, I mean, the stuff at work, they're paying for a dedicated connection, or they're paying for, they've got an SLA. They've got all the stuff that you don't have at home because you don't need it at home. That's generally why it's slower. Although, I mean, I guess it doesn't have to be that way. I have a business class connection at home, and really the only thing that gets me with Comcast is
static IP,
unblocked ports, and I can call the business class support and usually get a person rather than having to call the regular. But it's the same pipes. It's the exact same, goes over the same node and everything.
I like business just because I've always liked having that little pocket of static IP addresses.
It is nice. It's super nice.
You always know
to
where
have.
Home is without having to mess with, you know, dynamic DNS and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, it's nice to have.
Oh, so
yeah.
Does Comcast block some ports?
They block, yes, they block, yeah, they block port 80, they block 443, they block 25.
25, yeah.
But if you're on business class, they don't. So you can, and I run web server out of my closet and a whole bunch
I
of
swear
stuff.
I do something with 443. I can't remember what it is.
That's SSL. Blocked.
I'm pretty sure it's, I know 80 SSL. And 25 are blocked, and I right. thought 443 and
inbound
I thought all
443
the
oh, probably
AIM.
Is.
AIM runs on 443, and I use AIM.
Well, I mean, but you're not running an AIM server. You're not listening for incoming
no.
connections.
Yeah,
on.
So it's the way they do the firewalls. It's stateful, so if you do the request out, it'll allow the traffic back in, but you can't just have traffic coming in blind.
Yeah.
They will block
even
that.
Even if you forward the port. They're blocking it upstream from
and
you.
Certain sites, just even in the last couple of weeks, I've not been able to hit like from my Comcast connection at home, and I'm like, well, that's odd. And then I'll go to my other connection and try, and they're up. So Comcast is definitely doing some filtering on the website too, with actual sites, specific sites.
Interesting.
What a pain. Yep. Not on the business class side. They leave us alone, at least for now.
Leave me alone.
At least for now.
Well, that's. I'm guessing they figure as long as they've got that support, because I don't know, you know. Sort of segueing a little bit into news, I don't know if you saw, they had the second round of comments on net neutrality.
Oh, no, I didn't know the second. I didn't know.
In the first round, the comments were very strongly, like
oh, yes,
90% in favor of net neutrality legislation. Second round, the like response round went not the other way, but it was like 60% against net neutrality. And not only that, most of the stuff that was opposing net neutrality was form letters from one organization.
It sounds like a real American commitment.
So it's a real grassroots, real AstroTurf moment to in the comment phase. The problem with that is, of course. All they have to do is sort of not mention the part that these all came from, you know, one organization, and they can, go against net neutrality and claim that they are, you know, listening to they've listened to the comments and weighed them out. Where right now, what's happened is basically everybody's sort of canceled out. So that's no fun. Although, you know, you just wonder, will the day ever come that, you know, I'm not suggesting anybody do anything wrong, but you would think it's almost surprising that a group like Anonymous hasn't learned from the Sony hack about the effectiveness of a real proper doxing on a large organization.
Can we talk about Sony for a second?
Oh my sure. gosh, yes. Did you hear the
for a couple
latest,
of hours maybe? Yeah.
The latest as of just a couple of hours ago?
Yes.
They canceled
the interview, the movie that supposedly the Guardians of Peace hacker group was all up in arms about. So first the group had threatened that any theaters that show the movie that they would bomb and blow, or they were going to bomb and blow up the premiere.
They would experience a 9/11 type event.
Right. Whatever. So theater chains began canceling. The premiere was canceled. The press tour was canceled. And now, just as of a couple of hours ago, Sony Pictures is saying that the movie will not be released at all. No direct video, no theatrical, nothing.
They're going to vault it
and call it done.
That's going to make it more coveted.
So they're saying, like, no iTunes?
Nothing. It's on the BBC and a whole bunch of other sites.
I believe
right now.
They said it. I don't believe they meant it. And you will be watching, because at work, there were people going, now I really want to see that movie. I wouldn't have wanted to watch it because it looked like it was awful, but now I want to see it. And it does. It looks like one of those stupid stoner movies.
It does. And it's, I mean, personally, this is just me talking. I don't even think there's validity behind the state level threats about the movie anyway. I think that's I think that's crazy.
Any more than the North Korea can get in one of its wimpy ICBMs over here, they can't even get a couple of terrorists into a movie theater after buying the juju beans.
Yeah, so to back it up, I guess there was a hacker group that said that they were Guardians of Peace, GOP,
right.
And this was about a week and a half ago, or when did this all kind of happen?
It's been a little longer.
It's been a little
longer,
2 weeks ago. So they broke into Sony through some off-the-shelf kind of hacks. At the time, they had a real beef with this movie being released, but at the time there was some speculation as to, are they kids? Are they? What are they? I think at the time, did North Korea said it wasn't, they were happy about it, but it wasn't them.
Right. They said it was a righteous deed,
yes.
Which is a great phrase.
Righteous.
But this afternoon, along with that, with the news about Sony pulling it, the U.S. government said, yep, it was North Korea.
So that's kind of a big deal. So that is kind of pointing. And my reaction to that was, so they're threatening us. They're actually, and Dwight's comment was, well, they've been doing that for forever.
That's right.
So, yeah, I guess.
And they're threatening. And Sony, keep in mind, is a Japanese corporation doing business in the U.S. Sony Pictures is, for all intents and purposes, an American company.
Yes.
And so there are obviously there are certain policy implications. There are certain state-level implications to them doing that if the U.S. government's you know, if the intelligence data that they have is correct, there's obviously some. But the bigger implication is that you had essentially a government going into a corporation's computers and taking the company down. It was state versus corporate.
That's been going on for a little while, actually. Like the China, the PRC
but
has
it's
been
new,
doing
it's,
that.
It's information gathering. It isn't destructive.
And
this
as
shows
opposed
the
to
potential.
China, they released it, and you can show clear harm to Sony from this. I mean, Sony basically.
Oh yeah, the releases are going in stages, but it's been validated by lots of independent sources. Ars Technica, we've looked at the stuff too. I mean, the stuff that this group is releasing is legitimate information yanked from like emails to and from
payroll
movie stars,
things.
Payroll information. Right. And in fact, it's to the point now where Sony has retained some very high-profile attorneys and has now begun telling media outlets, including Ars Technica's parent company, Condé Nast, like, look, you know, if you continue to publish this, we're going to come after you.
Right.
Be advised.
It's David Boies, the Microsoft.
Yes.
The Microsoft antitrust attorney.
Yeah. So it's not that they're saying, like, don't report the news, but they're saying if you go and, you know, leak more emails from you know, our CEO or whatever, that we consider that. I don't know if they said it was DMCA that they were going to go after or if it was going to be something else, but they basically said, you know, stop.
And it has created quite a dilemma for media organizations. The New York Times told its reporters, don't open that email, don't look in there. The New York Times has a policy where they will chase stories that have already been reported, but they're not to go in there and develop stories themselves. I was on This Week in Tech on Sunday with Christina Warren, who had done the story about how the Steve Jobs movie fell apart based on emails from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, she took quite a bit of heat from Leo and John Dvorak as to whether or not she should be she should have done that, and whether or not news organizations should be sifting through stolen documents. Of course, news organizations do that all the time, the Edward Snowden documents, the Pentagon papers, but this is a little different. This is not national
internal
security.
Dirty laundry versus the national
security. Is this newsworthy, or is digging down to that level prurient and not newsworthy?
If you're an entertainment business news reporter, there probably is valid information in there. And what was interesting about Christina Warren's Steve Jobs story is a lot of what she found in the emails had already been reported as leaks in Hollywood, which leaks like a sieve.
Nice.
And so basically she just was able to confirm it based on the emails. You know, she used the emails to confirm what had already been reported.
Well,
so the thing I love about this story is that there are so many, many, many levels to it there are many interesting things regarding it, both from an information security standpoint, from a journalism ethics standpoint, from a hold on a second.
We're catching. We're running a tight ship in here.
Yes. Yes. So from a business news perspective,
right. Mm-hmm.
And now apparently from a national policy and a national security perspective, because it was state sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, it is probably the richest hacking technology story in a long time.
As far Absolutely. As just sheer amount of data dumped, it's the largest trove I've heard about.
Well, because, yeah, the intrusion and the exfiltration was total. I mean, you know, we're talking potentially just terabytes of information.
So can companies, I mean, do we expect companies to be able to protect this data? I mean, that really what we're doing is if we say yes, we're setting them up not with an impossible task, but with an extremely expensive task.
I think it's interesting, you know, Sony does seem to have more ability, seems to be having more ability to slow this down as far as at least in the media than, say, all the celebrities whose naked images and videos got leaked all over the place. It's an interesting contrast, I guess, would be the way to put it.
I think it's one of volume at this point, because the Sony stuff, the group that did all the exfiltration, they haven't released everything yet. It's still kind of coming out in
yeah.
dribs and drabs.
Well, also you have to work to get the really interesting stuff out of, presumably, you know. Obviously, if your deal is you're searching for celebrity nudes, once you see some, then you've
you have seen them.
Got
versus
your goal.
You've got here's 25 gigs of emails. It's like, well, it's okay. I have them. What do I do now?
Clearly, people keyword searched things like Angelina Jolie and some of that kind of the usual
right.
things that people would do when they can get to a doc dump. We do have a caller who had a comment on the whole Sony hack thing.
All right.
So let's see if I get this right. And,
we'll either put this person on the air, or we will hang up.
It looks
up
like
on this
he's
person.
On air. He's green on the air.
Well, no, it's blinking. I don't know what blinking means.
He's on hold as far as the button.
Let me do it in here.
Yeah,
here we go.
Okay, so
we're surrounded.
Jello.
Oh. Hello.
Hey, you know, greetings from San Francisco, actually, land of KPFA.
Oh, wow.
Hi, sister station.
I was kind of listening with interest in this. I had originally called regarding Sony, and I was going to compare it to the producers, you know, that they knew they had a genuine dog, and they created a fake foreign policy incident. Now they can make more money on a crap movie than bootlegs.
But the good version of the producers, not the remake.
Yeah,
that they did.
Although in the producers, they didn't cause the release of five other hits that hadn't been released yet. And all kinds of embarrassing information about themselves.
Yeah, that's the thing. A number of movies that have yet to actually wind up in theaters are out there floating around now.
Yeah.
You know what I was going to, as you were talking afterward, I got into this idea that they've basically, I'm more of an economist, right? So I'm looking at this, they've taken their crimes and they've basically copywritten them. And so they've monetized their corporate crimes as like a business secrecy. So that they can't disclose their crimes because it's business, business.
It's copyrighted materials. I guess
sure.
In a sense, I think that that really the lawsuits are more like slap suits, where the deal is most people aren't going to stand up to Sony's willingness to spend money on legal teams to keep doing it.
That's the judgment.
That's the
judgment call that the media companies. Own legal departments have to make, you know what?
Yeah.
It's not just is reporting this right or not. It's if we go down this road and we get challenged in court, can we win? What's this going
to
cost?
Sony needs to stop the bleeding, and they're doing it with high-priced legal teams right now.
Sure.
They're slapping money.
Hey, one last thing: is there any sense of is this movie a Doctor Strangelove or what's that one? Blowback?
No, it's more like The Hangover 4. It's one of these.
Yeah.
It's one of these goofy, stupid guys doing stupid.
It's
crap
nothing to be
movies.
Taken seriously.
No.
They just chose some poor low-hanging fruit to make the subject
yes.
matter
of.
Although I guarantee you the South Park guys, remember America World Police?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Are saying, what the heck's wrong with us? We made him sing. We made Kim Jong Il sing about how ronery he was.
Yes. Now, this movie stars James Franco and Seth Rogen. I guarantee at some point it's going to have the two of them and Kim Jong Un lighting up and smoking
it's
a bowl.
Pineapple
on air.
Express 2.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There much. You go. Well, you know, and that gets into a whole different other possibility. When you look at it, I don't know if you all are. Probably aware of who Joe McCarthy was, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, and the senator right next door in Michigan was one of the youngest World War II vets. His name was Senator Potter from Michigan. He writes this book about Joe McCarthy, and he, from the start, I mean, he kicks it off with the first chapter saying that the Communist Party endorsed him the first time Joe McCarthy ran for Congress in 1946. So for the Wisconsin chapter of the Communist Party, they endorsed. And that's in his first chapter. He goes on to show how basically Joe McCarthy, when he's on live TV with millions of people watching, he outs a forward base. A city of 20,000 people was a top secret base. Joe McCarthy outs it on live TV. And so he's seen as either an idiot or a saboteur, or actually a saboteur is kind of the way Potter ends it out. Because he really shows that Joe McCarthy was not just corrupt, he not just stupid and corrupt, but he was kind of venally corrupt. And he was, and there's just layers of this Senator book, Senator Potter's book. I think it's Days of Deceit is the name of it. Amazing book. But so if you look at the Cold War, we've locked the South Korean Peninsula away from the North Korean Peninsula now for, you know, 75 or 100 years or something. Probably Japan invaded, so it's been tied up since before World War II. These southern can't meet grandma anymore. Cousins rise and fall and never meet each other, even though they're basically miles away. Whole families split up because of this whole phony Cold War that they ran for all of these years. And for them to come up with a movie that exacerbates it, keeps the South and the North further apart. And it's just kind of the triviality of it, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if they were necessarily thinking about that. It was probably just a silly movie that they wanted to put out.
And he's an easy target.
Yeah, he's sort of the modern Nazis. Well, thanks for the call. We definitely appreciate it.
Yeah, and Dennis Rodman is who I blame for this whole thing. He put this whole thing in motion.
He needs to quit going over there.
I mean, really, he shined the spotlight on that. And there is some excess over there. And I don't want us to get any kind of threats here at the station. But, you know, what comes around goes around on that side.
All right, so what else is happening in the canoes?
Let's see.
What does Lee have?
Well,
oh, yeah.
You got something, Lee?
Got something, Lee?
No. Lee was motioning that we've got another call coming in online,
yeah.
Too. Separate call from the first call.
Well, I'll bring one up. You know, we had mentioned Comcast. One of the stories I did last week involved a lawsuit filed against Comcast in San Francisco.
Okay.
Regarding the Xfinity Wi-Fi public
hotspots
that Comcast set up in cities across the country, including Houston.
Yeah.
So if you've got an Xfinity.
Is this a class action?
It was filed as a class action. And I don't think it's been certified yet, but that's what they're requesting. So if you have a Comcast Xfinity router / modem, it's the tall black one that's, you know, stands up. And you have not gone in and opted out. It is broadcasting a second Wi-Fi network other than the one you run, called Xfinity Wi-Fi, that anyone who is a Comcast customer can connect to.
They can log in with username and password.
They can log in, right, with their username and password. And the idea is that if your friend comes over, they're a Comcast customer, they can log into your network and use it. If you are I live in an apartment complex, and I can walk down the hallway and stay connected to Xfinity Wi-Fi as I walk down the hallway, because there's a whole bunch of them in the doors on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a certain convenience factor.
What if you live, like, I've heard this story going around. What if you happen to live across from a school and, you know, your Wi-Fi is within range of all these school kids that can't get to any other Wi-Fi because they're school block stuff. And suddenly they're like, why don't I have any bandwidth? Why is this happening? And
fortunately, the Xfinity Wi-Fi router doesn't have that great a range. So so that's one of the benefits. But if you have your own modem and or router, You're not affected. Right. It's if you're running there. So
this is what I recommended my parents do too.
Yes.
Is not right. Go with the Comcast provider.
So the lawsuit basically says that Comcast did this without users' permission, which is true. That it's a security risk, which Comcast says no because it's two separate networks on two different sets of bonded
channels. It is, but at the same time, what I have seen this in the wild. It's very easy to fake that splash screen and just put that up and bring up your own little Wi-Fi access point with the web server and say, "Hey, I'm Xfinity Wi-Fi. Yes. Log into me." And then the next thing you know, you put in your real credentials.
Right.
Then they've got credentials.
It's easily spoofed. Yeah. So they also claim that it uses up your extra electricity, sending a small amount.
That's the part I'm least worried about.
Right. So that lawsuit has been filed, and so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I think Comcast made a big mistake in not making it opt in as opposed to opt out. I think doing it at the very least, the public relations issues that they've had as a result of that hurt them. I wrote a bunch about it, including how to get it turned off and how to do it. And those blog posts are on some days, even though that was several months ago, the most viewed things on my blog.
That's wild.
Because people are searching for that and finding it. So
you're definitely right. They've just made an absolute public relations belly flop with how it's been presented.
I didn't hear anything about it until I started seeing Xfinity Wi-Fi show up, on like War Driving Escapades and stuff. So did you hear about it? Were you forewarned?
Well, I mean, they came to me with
the
story. They came to me with the story and said, I did this, I did the blog post when it broke. We did a story in the paper. And the comments on the my blog and in the story, people were just outraged. Some people said, "Oh, this is good; it's convenient." And since it's happened, and I did the story about the lawsuit, the comments have largely kind of been 50-50. Some people said, "This is really convenient; I like it; I'm glad they're doing it." And other people are saying, they should have asked permission.
It's kind of a knockoff of. Hopefully, you didn't say that while I was answering calls, but. It's kind of a knockoff of that company. Is it in Brazil that had the thing where it's like, yeah, you get your internet connection, but then you also agree to essentially share out the. It's one that's sort of they're mostly not reported as a technology story, but more as a kind of human rights or a making internet available in one of the South American countries. There's a company that's gotten pretty large by doing that, where it's sort of the Tom's Shoes thing, which is you agree. Of course, you agree up front and with clear knowledge that you're going to – that when you get your connection, that it will share out the Wi-Fi. And, of course, once they get enough customers, when they get that critical mass in an area, then they have kind of full coverage. And, it benefits – the more people sign up, the more it benefits their
– Well, I'm sure Comcast is – from a strictly legal perspective, I'm sure they're covered too. I'm sure somewhere in just the dictionaries full of legalese, there's some passage that basically says they can do whatever
they want
to do
with it. Right, right. And, it to a certain extent – devices, the routers that they're using were clearly designed to support this. They got these out.
I think the only way they would be vulnerable is if somebody figured out a way to get from that free public side into an individual who had their, through that same router that they were able to get onto their local network.
That'd be the part that I'd be worried about the least. I mean, that's just basic. That's just set up a VLAN. That's just basic Ethernet bridging.
Absolutely. I'm just saying, I think that's the only way they'd be open, because otherwise, if you're just getting to internet, you're not.
It's not like you've got to worry about, somebody coming in off the street and breaking into your local area network through the Comcast public Wi-Fi. I mean, I'm all about Comcast being evil just as much as the next guy, but I mean, they know how network management works. They're not dummies. As much as we like to rail about how terrible the customer service is, I mean, these guys know what they're doing from a technical standpoint.
This isn't the equivalent of if Comcast water made it so that people could walk into your house and get a glass because you've got water.
No, but it is kind of like if they installed like a free porta potty outside that used your water supply, and all of a sudden everybody's out there flushing, and you're like, why does my sink not have any water pressure? That's the thing that would irk me about it if I was in a position to be able to to opt out, which I'm not. Business class is not. Right. It uses a whole separate set of, I have a different gateway from the regular one. But I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like, I'm paying top dollar for the privilege of using Comcast's pipes. And the idea that, you know, I can take my login data and go, you know, use it somewhere else just doesn't balance over the fact that somebody else could, you know, park their car outside my house and download whatever on my connection and eat my bandwidth. And
well, in theory, this is what Comcast has told me, that it doesn't, in theory, it doesn't impact your bandwidth.
Yeah, I don't see how that's possible unless they're, you know.
They can tell the same way they're segregating the traffic.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, here's how DOCSIS works, and this is how it was explained to me. The DOCSIS 3.0 modems that they're using have multiple channels. And
yes.
The way they add speed to your bandwidth is to add another channel.
Yes.
So if you have a 25 megabit service, they add a second channel to get you to 50, right?
Yes.
So what they, and these are capable of 300 megabits. What they sell right now at max for residential is 150, I believe.
That makes sense, yeah.
So if, and Comcast told me that if you have a 100 megabit connection, the Wi-Fi, the Xfinity Wi-Fi connection served to the public is 100 megabits.
So
it matches what they have, so they can go up to 150 on each end.
So they can allocate additional channels.
Channels, right. Bonded channels
that
to the
sense.
Other side. So.
Okay, well then I retract. I do see how that works.
So,
but I still don't like it.
Here's
so
the
they
thing.
Need to take down the shanty town outside your house and stop using, or it's okay for them to leave up the shanty town of squatters who are using your internet, your high speed internet.
The issue is your DOCSIS 3.0 modem can handle 300 megabits, but can the squirrel chewed wires and coaxes on the poles outside your house support 300?
Well, and all of the modems on a given area all roll up into the same node.
Right.
And that node has a fixed backhaul capacity.
Right. So at some point, it could indeed impact bandwidth at that level.
Maybe.
I'm guessing, you know, the odds are that somebody is not going to sit out in front of your house and stream Netflix movies.
No.
You know, or that's going to happen in front of a lot of houses. What's probably going to happen more likely is your phone will stay on, it will be on the network when you're out in the front yard for data instead of having to go to your LTE, or
potentially,
if you're at the
yeah.
neighborhood pool, you might be able to get a connection with your mobile device that you wouldn't ordinarily, and you're not going to probably sit there and like try to stream the game or whatever kind of thing. So it may just be, I think some of this is because AT&T and some others kind of stole a march on Comcast on getting, you know, with like, what is it, Starbucks, I think. If you're an AT&T customer, then you can use a Wi-Fi, you know, the ones that they're providing at Starbucks, you can
right.
get free, and they're using that as a marketing thing, and I guess this is sort of...
I think content. It's free everywhere now. I used to be a subscriber.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I actually had to pay to get Wi-Fi at Starbucks when we were all like, hey, give it away for free. You had to charge. And then I think AT&T came in and they gave it away for free. And now, just a few weeks
Google's,
ago, I've been seeing Google.
Google's
yeah,
doing
Google's
it, right.
actually doing it now.
So these two stories that we've been talking about tonight, the Comcast and... Sony have come together mysteriously because Comcast has now said that they will not make the interview available for streaming or on demand because it's too politically sensitive.
Now, when they say they're not going to make it, they mean how does that equate?
Well,
they're going to block
VOD
it?
Service.
They're not going to let people
They're simply not going to offer it.
Okay.
I mean, they won't block it internet-wise. They'll block it.
They just won't offer it.
They won't offer it as part of their
well, don't they service. Have a stake in some VOD service?
Are
they
we negotiating
do,
with terrorists because of this? So if this is like that kind
it's,
of a threat,
I would call it less negotiation with terrorists and more
chickening
Neville,
out.
More Neville Chamberlain
right.
style appeasement.
Right.
Frankly.
Right.
We all know how well that works.
Well, Comcast has its own video on demand. I mean, they have video on demand. And they offer, you know, like...
Is that their Xfinity service?
That's Xfinity, right. It's their cable TV service has on demand. And so they've told the Wall Street Journal that tonight that they're not gonna offer it. Be interesting to see if it was offered to Apple, if iTunes, it would show up on iTunes.
Who knows? Maybe not. I doubt it. I somehow doubt it. When are we going to get the... When are we going to get our when are we going to get our municipal gigabit fiber networks, Dwight? let's fix all of this.
I think we should just start hiking a strand of fiber out to Austin and just leech off some of the Google fiber out there. I think I saw the next round of Google plans, and Houston is not among them. They're looking
Houston
at North Carolina, and they're looking at.
That's because you know when Google Fiber launched, and they said, "Okay, cities, come and apply." Houston was MIA. Houston did.
I mean, I don't even need Google Fiber. I would be happy with just a municipal fiber network, but I just don't see that happening.
This is 600 square miles, and mm-hmm. Houston is very spread out. It'd be very difficult to do.
I live down in little bitty League City. We could do it. That'd
right.
be great.
League City, a small municipality yeah. could do it if they wanted to do it. But, of course, this is also Texas, my friend.
Right.
And that smacks of socialism.
Yes, mm-hmm. it does, we say from the offices of KPFT.
You'll get Ted Cruz on your ass if you start talking like that.
Well, that's the last thing I need is Ted Cruz coming over.
Hey, Pete, do we have a call? Oh, no. No, no, no.
No? All right. Well, that's
too many blinky lights.
No, I'm sorry. I'm trying
Pete's
to
running
that.
The board like a like he's like,
it's like an
he's
octopus.
Like a DJ in there, man.
He's overwhelmed.
He's rocking it.
It's like an old it's like the old Hanna-Barbera cartoon, and I'm the octopus on the drum kit in every undersea band you ever saw.
So what's our next story if we're doing stories?
There was something I wanted to try that I had sort of posted up to try. We're reworking the show a bit, you know, as regular listeners may have noticed,
because you have not heard any tech support for dial-up modems this evening.
But to be more about, well, essentially the number of calls for people who need tech support has dropped off because devices have gotten better, I mean arguably. But the other thing is, now if you think about it, we've really moved into an age of where it's how do we live with technology. And so we're kind of reworking the format. It's a little bit – it's in flux right now, and we're going to be, you know, refining it some more into the new year. But one of the things that I wanted to work in is that's harder to do in this kind of conversational approach is, you know, new stuff, new tech, new announced things. And so I've come up with a segment that we're going to try out. We'll try out for the first time tonight, which is try, buy, or fry. So I'm going to go through. I've got a few stories on some new items, and if you guys have some to add to it, then we'll work those in too. And then essentially the idea is this new device something you'd be interested in trying that you definitely would want to purchase, you know, that this is kind of, you know, it's a slam dunk for you, or is it something that you would deep six or, you know, but that didn't rhyme with try and buy, so...
So
fry is what was left. So I've got a few quickie stories.
We could have done try, buy, or die.
Or cry.
Cry.
yeah, the PR person on the other end
or
of that
sty.
Press release or whatever. So we can, like I said, it's a work in progress. So since this is the first one, I've got three stories, and then we can see if we should add some more. And you may have heard of some of these, but we haven't talked about them on the air up to
now. All right,
now.
I'm ready.
The Hemingwrite. It's a Kickstarter project, which is essentially a device that channels the gestalt of an old-fashioned typewriter. Instead of, you know, typing on paper, though, it's an electronic device. It uses a 6-inch e-ink display. And then the device stores your composition, stores what you're writing in the cloud via a wireless signal. It's up on Kickstarter. Apparently, the idea, it has a mechanical keyboard with Cherry MX switches straight out of the 1980s. Now, quick aside here, how many people ever thought that people would be nostalgic? I get nostalgic for the typewriter because the physical action, you know, the mechanical interlinks where when you push a button you feel that resistance, etc. But that people would be nostalgic for the mechanical switch clicks of the...
Oh, yeah.
It's completely believable.
Are you kidding?
Yeah,
it's totally believable.
That's something you deal with every day. And
I have a Model M keyboard at
non-buckling.
Home that I use. I have a buckling spring keyboard Model M at home that I use.
I have a feeling that we have a relatively unique population compared to most. But, okay. So is this something... Yeah, they're talking about... that the price is going to be between, say, $350 and $500 right now.
Do not want.
No. I didn't want it from the beginning. I don't. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of, like, photo.
Not only do I not want it, but the first time I see someone pull one of these out at Starbucks, I am going to punch them.
You're gonna hit
Can't you just get a
iPad?
Keyboard and a tablet? Or, like, or in this case, a keyboard and a really small phone?
Oh, here's an idea is that everybody here's an idea somebody can steal. Then the cover for an iPad that uses Cherry MX switches from 1980s keyboard. Think about how bulky that would be. Funny, because it'd be like this huge, thick thing with your iPad kind of badly. It needs to be
like,
badly mounted on it to get that 80s feel.
Yeah, it would look like an iPad, but like from Tron.
And
like
with,
something you'd pull out from the Tron version of the future.
With a duct tape-looking hinge that connects it to the keyboard.
No, it would have like a ribbon cable, like an exposed ribbon cable.
I get, you know, although there, you know, part of, I guess this is for hipster computing, because the idea is, of course, you won't get distracted. It's like the people who only want to use like a laptop screen to do their computing work because they feel like if they have any more real estate, they'll see other things and get distracted.
Oh, so single purpose computing.
So, okay, so that one, I guess for somebody who can't figure out this is easier, this is probably easier than those electronic typewriters. You remember those that had the heat that used the fax paper to type on in the 80s? There was like
Dwight
Sharp and some of those.
I vaguely remember those.
I had one of the 90s that didn't do the heat, but it actually had like a little two-line, like maybe 32-character LCD display, and you could actually save about 25K to memory and then retype things. That was awesome.
Those were called, I think those were word processors.
Yeah, those were actually, that might have been a word. But the thing, even then, those were still cheaper than this product.
That's true. Okay, so so there's that one. Here's one this is relatively more obscure, but Seagate has come up with a new technology to store data called shingled magnetic recording, SMR. And the thing about shingle, it stacks up where it writes the data like shingles.
Like overlaps a little bit.
Or else if you had the chicken pox when you were a kid, the drive works for you.
You get the
shingles
if you lose all your data.
No, the value part of this, the place where the interest comes is that the new drives can store 8 terabytes of data for about 3 cents a gig. So you're talking about
a couple hundred
big
bucks.
Capacity for, relatively speaking, little money. The catch, they're not very fast, 5,900 RPM, and an average read-write speed of 150 megabytes per second. It's a lot slower than an SSD drive or a 7,200 RPM hard drive. Shingled drives can cram more tracks onto a single platter and reduce the space between tracks. Let's see. So they work faster with an SSD. The best way to do them apparently is have a faster solid state drive on the front end and then store your data on the back.
Yeah, they're pitching them as a storage drive, especially for backups. I mean, at this point, there's no reason not to back up your multi-terabyte systems all onto a couple of drives, and these are the drives to do it on. I think the rest of the companies are messing around with helium technology to try and get the densities up. So this sounds like it might be a little bit cheaper to actually pull off the production.
This makes me nervous, man.
About?
Well, okay, so there's a I can't find the technical term and it's not coming to me, but there is a measurement that you apply when you're doing backups, especially backups to disks, where you talk about your likelihood of failure or your
mean time between failure.
No, MTBF? it's not MTBF. Or... It's the likelihood that for a given amount of data you'll have a single bit error when you try to retrieve it. And for 4 terabyte hard drives, it's almost like a one. Like if you try to read 4 terabytes off of a current 4 terabyte hard drive, read all of it, you're guaranteed to have at least one failure on read. So as you continue to crank these drives' aerial density up and you use them for backups, the likelihood that the drive will just wind up being this black hole like becomes more and more and more certain. They're fine to dump data onto and incrementally read, but if you ever come to a point where you need to pull a backup off of them, you almost certainly won't get a complete backup off of them.
We might be missing a couple of bits here and there, but usually the way you attack that is you're going to put those disks in a RAID where the chances, and you're going to do it like on a Linux kind of, you know, file system, that if it has a couple of bad inodes or it's missing a little bit of data, it'll recover, and then you gamble that across like four disks, you're not going to have that same exact piece of that same exact file missing on all four disks.
That's true too. But then you run into the issue with these 5400 RPM disks that aren't rated for 24/7 use in a RAID array, that they'll fail in other interesting ways. That's why you pay more for Western Digital has what are their RED drives. Mm-hmm. And I mean,
yeah,
that's
they're different rated. Yeah, different
you'll look at your shingle drive and it'll look like the neighbor's roof after the high winds came through.
Here's the thing, man. If you go buy an 8 terabyte, I think they're 8 terabytes, yeah, is what I read. That's the size of these things, right? Okay, so if you go buy an 8 terabyte drive and you've got 8 terabytes of stuff and you put all 8 terabytes of your stuff on this 8 terabyte drive, you're taking an awful risk with your data.
That smacks a lot, like 64Ks.
That's
all
why
you'll
you need
ever
another
need.
One to back it up.
That's why you need two of them. Right. You put them in a mirrored RAID array, but RAID is not a backup. RAID is an uptime solution.
Well,
don't
you just redundancy
RAID
with everything. You know, you never want to have, if something's really important, you want to have probably more than just one single backup of it.
My question is, how fast are these things?
Not very fast.
Slow.
Yeah.
5400 RPM. At what, that much?
150 megabyte per second. Average read write.
What was that?
150 megabyte per second.
That's actually pretty quick. 150 megs per second, considering it's a storage drive, and if you're
and it's at 100 and it's 5400.
That's
going to
be sustained.
RPM.
It's going to be sustained for
that's
like.
That's got to be their burst rate.
For a random read, random write, 4K random read, 4K random write, the throughput's going to be in the toilet for something like that. It just has to be. It's rotational latency.
So actually,
so fast.
It's a backup drive.
It's a backup drive, but it's not a backup drive that's rated to be used, powered on 24/7 as a backup.
They're calling it a storage drive.
Nearline.
So
it's a nearline.
They're not saying, hey, put your backups on here. They're just saying, hey, you can store a lot of stuff on here, and as Lee said, maybe use it at your own risk.
Yeah.
I guess it might be pretty effective for somebody who has like lots of, as part of a full solution, not as their only solution, but it does seem like it would be a great place if you're doing like photography like Jay does, where you've got large numbers of these huge files that you want to keep and you're accessing them. It's a planned thing, you know, where you could put it on the drive, turn it on, copy your pictures to it, you know, the latest batch of pictures, and then turn it off. And you've got other copies of the pictures, but you know you've got it. It becomes one of the extra solutions
for RAW. DEF CON this year, and they're starting to happen in a lot of different cons around the country, and they're going to do it next year. Is they had I think 66 bay disk cloning stations, so you could come in, and they're asking for either 2 gig. It was four terabyte drives, 3 different drives. What you do is you'd come and you'd drop off your clean drive in the morning, you'd get a little ticket for it. You know, they'd do his ticket, and you'd come back 11 hours later, and you had all 4 terabytes of every presentation, every talk, all the videos, everything very nicely curated. Probably some viruses and some other stuff.
I was just going to ask, it's DEF CON. How do you know?
Yeah, other stuff on there too. But the idea is that, you know, maybe this year it might have cost, you know, $600 buy-in to be able to, you know, get a couple of drives like that. Whereas next year you can fit all that stuff in, you know, a couple $100, which is pretty nice.
So anybody
that's
up
a good disposable use
know
for
the
it.
The button,
you know,
to push to get the door to open from in the
there's
area?
A button somewhere.
No, you're stuck in there forever.
Okay, well, I guess
you can just step away from the booth. We'll keep going.
I'll be right back.
Yeah, we've only got about 7 or 8 more minutes before we got to do a station ID.
We do.
I think we're good without Pete.
That's
so unless that's a serial killer at the door, we should be fine.
Well, I guess FCC. We'll know in a few minutes when Pete doesn't come back, or when someone else comes back and sits down and starts running the board. And
it's Seth Rogen.
So here's another thing. Lee, are you on Instagram?
No, I
are you on Facebook?
Nope.
No, he's not on Facebook.
No Facebook.
Did someone create a fan page for you, or is that your fan page on Facebook?
I don't know.
Because you're on Facebook, whether you know it or not.
He doesn't. He has like Facebook blocked on his network.
I have. I run my own DNS. I run my own Bind9 server, and I have Facebook.com blackholed on it. So nothing on my LAN can see. Nothing on my LAN can resolve IP addresses that are in Facebook.com's. That belong to Facebook.com.
I'm playing with the new Instagram app, which adds new filters. It's like for the first time in like 2 years, I think, that they've added new filters, 5 new filters, and they're pretty cool. But there's a problem with it. If you use Instagram regularly, you know that when you go to choose the filter, there's this little iconic thumbnail of a balloon, of a hot air balloon, and it shows you what each filter will do.
Right.
Well, they have changed that image, and now instead of a hot air balloon, it's a color sampling of your image rendered as a blob, an unrecognizable blob, and then the filter is applied to it. It tells you nothing. It looks awful. And I complained about this immediately on Twitter, and I got an email from a PR person working for Instagram saying,
yeah.
Oh, no, we have not taken away the thumbnail. It's just done differently. And it's terrible.
Okie dokie.
It's awful.
We've made it transparent.
We haven't taken it away. We've just changed it so that it doesn't do what you expect that it does
in order to better serve
you.
It's worthless. And so I left a review on iTunes, which I think I've done like two reviews in my life.
Well, that'll
on
show
iTunes.
Them, Dwight.
But I was that outraged that I called up iTunes to write it, because you have to write it in iTunes. I can't believe it's. I love the app. I love Instagram. I used to hate it. I used to think filters were silly.
I'm still there.
What can I do with that? So I think it was my cats maybe that.
I was using some old photos for a story that I was writing for Ars last year, and it was hilarious because I got asked, by one of my coworkers what Instagram filters I had used on the photos that I was uploading for the story. And I was like, I didn't. They're old photos. They look like this.
Right.
True vintage.
Well, so summing up, the shingle drive, was that a try, buy, or fry?
I think it's an inevitable. I think they're going to go that way, and I think they're going to get the speeds up.
Yeah.
They got to get the speeds up. But what about SSDs? What about you know, why do you, at some point, though the capacity for those are going to go way up.
Eight terabytes for $260
is ridiculously
good. You're not
going
to get that for a solid state for a high.
Not yet. There are lots of factors. There are factors about SSDs. SSDs follow the Moore's law curve because they're transistor based. We could. How long do we got? I can go down this road for as long as we want.
Well, we have a caller from last week who called on the Roku.
Oh yeah, he might have bought one.
He might think. And he called back, and so he's on.
Press the button for that.
Yeah, gentleman. I got that one from in here.
There you go. You're on the air.
Hello.
Oh wait.
He's not on the air.
No.
I wonder. Did I?
Well, the fellow should call back. We're gonna go do our little break in a minute here, but he should call back after that, and we'll talk to him.
Yeah, it's hard to know if that was whose error that was. I think I didn't have the. I know I must not have had the phone potted up. So. Board error on that. We don't have a PSA for the top of the hour, but I do know that since this show does get used in other places, I figure at 2 minutes till we'll play one of our. We're not going to play that song.
We are going to play that.
That is going to get played tonight, but I don't want to play it during the part where
we will not deprive our other.
Maybe we'll do that after we get back from the break, so that you all have something to look forward to. I think we're going to play another one of our cool 8-bit songs, and fill a couple minutes with that, and then we will be right back. So let's see. Now let's see if he can make this work and if it works like I remember it.
Don't we need to say something like you're listening to Technology
Bites?
We've
got about 30 more seconds or so on the clocks here. They like
a
clean
handoff.
We'll
say that at 9 when we come back. You know, yeah, you are listening to Technology Bites, and we'll ID it again when we come back.
Sweet.
Let's see what we got here.
Radio is cool.
All right. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. This is Technology Bites.
And we are back.
We are back. We didn't do it on the outro, but I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And I'm Dwight.
I'm used to waiting.
That's so
no, you see, now you get to go first because I'm just a guest.
There.
No.
And so actually, we're going to play that song in a minute. But there was one story that I had found that I thought was really kind of cool. It brings together geekiness and Christmas in a way that I'm hoping our show tonight is. an interesting question for people, and I thought it was a well written article I found on Wired. How about this one? Are Christmas lights in series or parallel?
That sounds like a Barrett question.
Are they these days?
And electric lights. You know, the simple circuit is, of course, you know, the bulb.
They used to be in series back in the day because one would go out, they would all go out, and you'd have to go and figure out which one was gone. And then I don't know when, sometime in the mid '80s, they went into parallel, where you could have a single light bulb go out, but yet the entire strand would still be burning.
But do you know why? When the but then with that though, doesn't that mean that if one bulb goes out, half the string could go out?
Within parallel?
Still, unless you did.
No. It's an individually wired to each, more or less. Because they've got a common cathode usually, or a common. I think it's common cathodes with. I've done LED stuff. I don't do much incandescent bulbs. But no, if they're wired up in parallel, it's fine.
If you look at they've got Christmas tree lights from before they went parallel, then there was just like one string, but mm-hmm. now there's a third line that goes all the way down.
It connects them all together. And that's when I say common cathode, they all share a common single ground.
Right.
So before, you would break one line would burn down and the ground would go and you had no route for electricity to get back. Now, any of them can burn out, all of them can burn out, and you've always got that path back.
Right.
I like that better. I remember being a kid and being the one charged with tracking down the one
bulb.
Which
one?
Assuming there's one, what if you get into the thing where there are two dead ones in a string? Then it's, you know, the combinations are just ugly on that.
Yes. It's like, it's
160
also,
times 159 different combinations.
Now, you're probably not this old, but going with your dad to the convenience store where they had the tube tester, and you weren't sure which tube had gone out in your television
set.
No,
I'm not that old, luckily.
Yes, my dad used to take all the tubes out of the TV set. We'd go down to the 7-Eleven. He'd have them in a shoebox. They had a machine that you put it in to test, and it would tell you, and all these different connections, so it would match every bulb. And then they sold the bulbs in the convenience store.
No, I had no idea that happened.
Yes.
I missed you, Dwight. This is awesome.
Which raises sort of an interesting thing to me, which is, hipsters like vinyl records and stuff. You know, they like the old. And I'm sure if you offered them a tube amplifier, they mm-hmm. would go nuts for it. But I haven't seen the ultimate hipster who's looking back to the days of TVs with tubes and who wants to go back to the, what was it, 240p?
Yes.
Or
no.
240.
Although, I will be one of the people that say, I don't like how 4K looks sometimes, and I think it can be jittery, and I kind of like that fuzziness.
That's because it's a cheap 4K.
Well, that's probably why.
That's
the
why.
Ones I've seen recently.
The ones that are good, it cost you a lot.
I haven't seen a 50K 4K yet. It's probably what I'm missing out on here. Now I guess they're getting to 8K range.
Have you seen the 4K iMac or the 5K iMac? Have you seen it?
I reviewed it.
All right. Have you? Did you play a Blu-ray on it?
No.
Did you play any movie on it?
I played some demo 4K content because I had to test out how Final Cut Pro 10 worked.
And it looked awesome, didn't it?
The native stuff looked really good.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting side question, though, because to display native 4K content on the 5K iMac, it upscales slightly because the rest
because
of the screen is 5K instead of 4K.
K, right.
But you can, what I think one of the reasons why they did 5K is if you're in Final Cut Pro 10 and you maximize the screen, you can edit your 4K video at native resolution non-scaled and still have room around the edges for the chrome that you need with the editor.
The buttons and
which was
stuff, right.
Very, very handy, actually. If I had been editing 4K content, I would have really liked that.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's an incredible machine to watch stuff like that on.
It's absolutely beautiful. It made my, and I had it on the desk with my two Thunderbolt displays plugged into it, and it was like, crap, beautiful, crap. Like,
but 16 more pixels than 1080p. So, I mean, it's a pretty big 16 jump up.
16 times.
16 times more pixels. Sorry, 16
That's right.
times,
when
yeah.
you take,
not
when
just
you,
16 more
pixels. When you take a 1080p image, it, like, runs down in the little corner down in the...
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Well,
So, can we talk about records then for a second?
Sure, we can.
I was
that
curious
then...
about that. So, a lot of stuff has been coming. I guess there was a, I don't know where he worked for, but there was an engineer that kind of came out of hiding, and he was talking about how in, I guess, the last year or so, the demand for vinyl has actually doubled. Like, they're cutting twice as many records as they used to. They're having a hard time finding lathes. All these guys that cut the records, they're all in work. Now, albeit, you know, that even though it's doubled, that still can only constitutes maybe 1 or 1.5% of average annual record sales. So it's still a very, very small amount. But what's happened is it's kind of sparked this nouveau debate on the internet, which is better? You know, is vinyl better or is CD better? And there are a lot of different ways to talk about that, but I know that we've got Dwight here, and Dwight was a music editor for a while. And the thing that I didn't necessarily realize, I'd always heard about the loudness wars, and the loudness wars is, it's this idea that right around, I guess, the time when the Discman, the Sony Discman came out, and right about the time that Dire Straits, that first CD that sold a million, mm-hmm. you know, albums, or a million CDs rather, wow, got out, that the engineers that started mixing and mastering CDs started to eke up the volume levels in them just ever so slightly to compete with other CDs that were also kind of in this arms race of volume, because for some reason they thought that, you know, humans, when they hear something louder, it must be better.
I will tell you, that is true.
That is true.
I sold stereos at Lowe's now is everywhere and everybody knows what it is. When I was in college, there were 3 Lowe's in the state of Texas. And so when you said you worked at Lowe's, people asked if you got free popcorn and got to watch movies, because there were Lowe's theaters, which now there's no Lowe's theaters, but there's Lowe's stores everywhere. But so I worked in the electronics department, and there were people who and they had crummy stereos. I'll just say that. That was at that time, back then, they had those Sound Design, the plastic, where it's like all one big plastic body with all the components are all just melted together in one thing. And so people would come in, and we had the old one was discounted seriously, and they'd be looking at the new one that was, you know, $50 more because it wasn't old and discounted, and they would be trying to decide, and it was clearly they were going to like stretch their budget to do it. And those were the ones I would use the salesman trick on, which is I would turn the cheaper one up slightly louder comparing the content, and they would go, you know, that one really sounds better than womp, so it was a little womp. Psych experiment. It did work. I did it for good. I mean, these people basically, come on, between one year edition of the Sound Design plastic, you know, component system
sound
versus
design.
Another one was not a no. They did not lose. They saved money and they were happy with their purchase. But yeah, turning it up worked. And I and at first it was like, I'm just trying it. And then when they all said it, and I think that's what happened.
Yeah, and so there's this pervasive kind of, you know, I guess, thinking when it comes down to sound engineers. They're like, you know, I guess you used to have to make decisions if you're an engineer. Like, what am I going to bring to the forefront of the mix? And now a lot of the people that are saying, like, everything's the loudest in the mix. Like, the guitar is the loudest thing in the mix.
Right.
The drum's the loudest in the mix, everything. And the cool thing is there are a couple of YouTube videos floating around. Billy Joel had a CD released back in the early days of CDs, and someone ripped out, you know, that track off the original Billy Joel CD, and then they did a 30-year anniversary, digitally remastered, same song, same track, same sequence, same everything, only it's been remastered. So you'd think they would get the mixing down better, they'd bring out the nuances, they would just really kind of do
it
justice.
No, they mix it for the way people listen to music
They mix
now.
It really, really high, and you look at right. these two waveforms, and one of them, the new one, there is no
it's
middle.
Just
it's all completely
giant.
Solid.
Right.
Yeah, and so what they've done is, even those CDs, technically, they have more dynamic range. They have a lower right. sound floor. You can hear absolute silence, and you can go really high. They're not being mixed like that. So now the cool thing, this is the part I didn't know, is that the width of the groove when you're actually pressing vinyl controls how loud the track is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So because these sound engineers that are doing the vinyl have always been constrained by how many tracks you need to fit on a record, they don't have the room to get involved in the loudness war. So
right.
there's a natural default variable there, and they can't mix it all the way. So that's why you get a lot more mids and a lot more range.
So if you're buying music on iTunes now, and many are, you now see a thing that says mastered for iTunes.
Right.
And what that actually means is it's mastered for the way people listen to music now on tiny little headphones, mm-hmm. digitally, And it's so it's set to compensate. And it actually does sound a little bit better through Apple's little tiny crappy
headphones. Now, do you have a way to get other versions of that? Or when you buy that, you are buying the mastered for iTunes version?
I think if they have that, that's what they have.
Okay.
Don't
they have lossless versions on iTunes? I thought they had lossless iTunes songs you could buy.
Yeah, but not everything is like
that. AAC has a lossless version, doesn't it? Is there a lossless?
Yes, yes.
And then you've got, I think Pete mentioned, who is it that wants to do the Pono player?
Neil Young.
Neil Young wants to come out with like super uber duper oversampling, like 328K kind of stuff.
Good luck with that. That project is basically, that project is like, I don't want to call it dead because they have shipped a small amount of hardware, but it's basically dead.
It's pretty expensive, too. And you've also got FLAC, which stands for Free Lossless Audio Codec, that's been around for probably a decade now. Yeah. And that is free, and that throws away no information. Like, what you record into FLAC is what you get. And the file sizes are about half, a third of what a WAV file would be.
There's a really – I'm in the middle of reading Stephen Johnson's How We Got to Now, which is a fascinating book about the history of basic technologies. It starts out with glass and how glass has become ubiquitous and how important it is to society. And then it does cold, and which is astonishing when you think that in the mid-1800s, there was no ice in the South and that there was no such thing as iced tea and there was no cold drinks. And then how refrigeration happened. And now I'm reading sound. And how sound began and headed towards amplification. And one of the things in this, I haven't gotten to this part yet, but I suspect it's in there, is that, you know how when you listen to old 78s, the voices are real high and they're pushing and they're kind of straining? It's because they were recorded by somebody sticking their head in one of those cones and singing into the cone.
Oh, the old wax cylinders.
It wasn't wax. I mean, they were doing vinyl.
Oh.
And I mean, not vinyl, but it was the acetate. And that's how they recorded it. And you had to really push. And so that high, strained, like bad operatic style was because of the nature of the recording equipment.
That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I think, and on playback too, it'd come back through a similar kind of metal kind of horn, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And then a lot of times you can actually open up the bottom cabinets to get more volume. And if you wanted to shut the volume down, you'd close the cabinets. And if that was still too loud, people would say, put a sock in it. And you would put a sock in the horn, and that's where that phrase comes from.
Put a sock in it.
Yep. Which now it's a little bit different term. If someone says, hey, put a sock in it, they'd be like, hey, what do you mean?
Well, speaking of music engineering and
put
a sock in it it's time for a holiday tradition of Technology Bites that we have done for many years.
Well, I haven't done one of these before, so I'm excited to be a part of it.
Have you heard the song?
All eyes on Lee Hutchinson tonight here in the studio. Oh.
So we will get at the end of this, we will get to
a virgin. He's a virgin.
Put a microphone down by the fetal positioned. We'll see if he's still gasping from laughing at it. There is a song that we play that I think it was done by a couple of audio engineers fooling around on a recording job, and you need to listen to it all the way through from beginning to end to get the full sort of impact. And so I think we always call it that song. The song is actually "Oh Holy Night." Or we oh holy something else if you wanna go there.
It's gonna be like an unholy night kind of night.
Play it and find out.
Pete, no spoilers.
No spoilers. Let's go.
All right. Well, so here it is. Everybody, clamp those headphones on, listen to it the way you like to listen to it, and enjoy.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pine, till he appeared
and the soap out. It's worth a thrill of hope. The weary world rejoices for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Fall on your knees. Oh, hear the angels' voices. Oh, night divine. Oh, night when Christ was born. Oh, night divine. Oh, night. Oh, night divine.
So
what did you think, Lee?
I'm just not sure how to feel about that.
But there are some feels, aren't there?
There's definitely something.
For a handful of years, no one really knew where that came from. I think Pete brought it to our attention, and there was some mystery. Well, like there were speculations, there were some stories floating around about where it actually came from. But the guy that actually put it together came forward 2 or 3 years ago and said, "I'm going to set the record straight." He was a music teacher, among other things. And a recording engineer. I thought he also taught music here and there. See, he wanted to show it to his students. The older guy. I'd probably need to go back and reread this, but that's what I thought the story was. But because he knows how to do everything, it's like jazz. You've got to know all the correct notes to be able to hit all the wrong notes, and that's what he did. Is he hit?
He did every technique. They were mixing an actual album that you can find with that mix. That's why it had the legitimate music behind it. And they were mixing it, and they were joking that the performer who they were actually mixing it for, that the reason he could hit the high notes was because he had a ponytail. And, and the other engineer, it was late at night, and they were kind of punch drunk. The other engineer's like, "Well, you got a ponytail?" And he's like, "Yeah, I can hit that note." And he went in, and the thing was, he was doing this for... He went in the booth, they played the backing track on some extra tape, and... He performed it for his friend, and so of course he did everything. The farther along he got, the more things he remembered. The more things he thought of to do wrong.
Right,
like hit a note wrong where you hit it low and then you go down. You go down or up from it, and all that. And apparently, what happens is record companies get bought and sold. They go out of business and they liquidate, and then they give the tapes. They give all these masters to interns. To dub down to other tapes to figure out what they've got
right.
and all that. And so So apparently every sound engineer or everybody who's involved in the kind of record business has got a tape full of stuff, like takes that they particularly liked that they pass around, and this one made the jump to the internet.
Woof.
And that high note that he hits is actually higher than what the performer did, because he was doing it by himself. That was supposed to be a choir behind him, and that was supposed to be the female voices in the choir singing that part, and he just went, he could read
he
the music, and he did it, and he got there, so.
He went there.
But I just love, because
he went in that direction, at least.
It just keeps getting better, or better slash worse slash better the longer the song goes, and I think that they really need to go through and do a full-on mix of that could be to put on holiday albums.
Steve Maldeen is the guy's name, if you want to Google and find the history on that.
Ah. And so, yeah, I think there's a YouTube thing with him. So he sings a little bit of it to prove it. Obviously, you can't just post a web page and say, yeah, I'm the O Holy Night guy. It's not going to work. But he does, you know, he gives information that basically, you know, only the person who did it could know and all that. So pretty funny. But we do have a caller who had a call, you know, who if I can get this right, when
why don't we pick it up in here.
Okay, so the
or they may already be on since we're green.
Active.
No, you're not green. Hit it.
And then you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey guys.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We can hear you. You're on the air with Technology
Bites.
Yeah,
who are we speaking with?
This is Jim Thompson.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Jim. What's up, Jim?
Turn your radio down, Jim.
Turn the blinking box off, Jim.
Turn the blinking box off. Quit staring at the blinking box.
Are you getting feedback?
No, we're not. We're just messing with you.
Oh, now I'm having trouble hearing you. Do I sound okay?
You do sound fine. There's a little bit of a delay between the time we ask you a question and you answer it.
Oh, that's because I'm not very bright.
You've got head lag.
Jim Thompson, by the way, is one of our great friends. He is a regular at Technology Bites. He has probably the most awesome science project in the world, a fishing tackle box filled with lights.
Called the Blinkin' Box. Blinkin'
Box.
Taken on a life of its own. Yes. It started out small, but it has grown. Yeah, geek gathering to geek gathering.
That's right. So what can we do for you this evening, Jim?
So that project's just a little bit on hold. I mean, it's something I truly want to get back to in a big way. But, you know, I just having trouble finding the time. The reason I asked how I sound is because I'm calling you tonight from my iPad.
Oh, nice. Which app?
Yeah, I'm using a feature that's new in iOS 8, and I believe Apple calls it continuity. It lets you take phone calls and send and receive SMS text messages, not iMessages now, but SMS messages to a plain cell phone through your iPad or your Mac, and it relays them through your phone.
Yeah, this is one of the features that was added with iOS 8 and Yosemite.
It's 8.1.
Yeah, I think they both have
8.1. Yeah, 8.1.
I think they both have to be on the same Wi-Fi network.
And Bluetooth must be turned on.
Correct.
Or Bluetooth. Okay. Yeah.
Well, so that's why I'm calling tonight. That was what I thought too. And you're right about the timing of the feature. I guess it was 8.1. Mm-hmm. I went to Detroit recently, and I got on my Mac. And I sent my wife a message, and expecting it to see it show up in the blue iMessage color, it showed up in the green SMS I'm relaying through your iPhone color, and the message went through. So,
if iMessage can't talk to the server. And for whatever reason, it can't talk to the server. It defaults over to SMS. And I suspect that there was something happening at that time that just wouldn't let it go through the iMessage server for whatever reason.
Well, that's fair enough. But my understanding was, like you guys just said, the phone and the computer or the phone and the iPad have to be either on the same Wi-Fi network or they have to be communicating by Bluetooth. In this case, I apologize, I left this out. I had forgotten my iPhone. I left it at home charging on the counter, the kitchen counter. So I'm in Detroit, and some way...
Oh, are you VPN'd in?
No, iOS 8.1 will also send text messages through iMessage to a non-iOS device on your iPad or on your Mac. It does that now. And so it could be that either it missaw, if your wife has an iPhone, it could be that it missaw that, or that it couldn't talk to iMessage in the right way, and so sent it in a fallback manner.
Well, my wife has an Android phone.
Well, that's why. But it will do that. It will do that now.
So it's not native iMessage. But my question is, and this is what stumps me a little bit, my computer in Detroit managed to contact my iPhone in Houston to send an SMS text message.
No, it didn't go through your phone.
It did. It must have.
No, it didn't. iOS 8.1 will now send text messages over by way of the internet.
Oh, it doesn't require a phone?
No.
There you go.
That's the magic of Apple, my friend.
Well, that ends the puzzle one, I guess, Dwight. I saw those messages go through, and then when I realized, wait a minute, my phone isn't with me.
Yeah,
how is this happening?
If you go back and look at the incredibly dull 2-hour demo of iOS 8.1 when they announced it, they talk about that in it. They actually show it being sent to an Android device from an iPad, I believe. So,
I recall the talk about that. It just seemed to me that they had expressed the requirement that your Mac and your iPhone be on the same Wi-Fi network or talking by Bluetooth.
It just
bewildered me when it worked the way it did. So I was happy to see that. I think that's brilliant work on their part. I think that whole feature set is just extremely cool. I would hear my phone ring, right, and I've got to sprint down to get to it before it goes over to voicemail.
Yes,
and now I just tell my Mac to.
We actually may have lost Jim there.
Did we lose Jim?
Go ahead, Dwight.
There he is.
Oh, he's back.
So if you the thing about being connected to Wi-Fi and Bluetooth has to do with your strictly with the telephony part of it, and being able to take and receive calls. You know, one of the tough things is if you have a Mac Mini doesn't have a microphone built into it. If you don't have some kind of microphone set up with a Mac Mini, like through your monitor, you can't do that. I have a Mac Mini with a monitor that doesn't have a microphone, and so I'd have to like get one of those old school, stand up microphones for a computer in order to do that. And so I dread when my phone rings and I get that thing up on the screen because I'd love to answer it,
but I can do
it on my MacBook. But I can't do it on my Mac.
As the sole Android user here in the studio tonight, I've got to say, that sounds a lot like Google Talk.
Jeez. Well, Google Talk interface with your PC?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it's kind of unnerving. But when someone calls my phone, my laptop will ring. Anywhere I'm logged into, Chrome will ring. Everything rings. I can take it from my laptop. I can take the call from wherever.
See, the only time I use Google Voice... which I guess is being integrated with Google.
Yeah, they're all kind of.
Is when I'm trying to sell stuff on Craigslist, and I don't want.
You don't
want to
give out your number? No, I've gone pure. That's the number I give out now. Is I give out my Google Voice number, and that was my old Grand Central number. But yeah, that's.
Yeah,
I
was on Grand Central too. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, cool, I think what you're saying essentially is that Skynet is becoming aware.
Yes.
You are correct, sir.
But at least it'll take our calls.
That's right. All right, thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, we'll see you at the Geek Gathering, not the first Friday, but the second Friday in January.
And bring the box.
Yes, I will see you the second Friday. Nice talking to you guys.
Right. Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jim. Always okay. Cool to talk to Mr. Thompson.
Oh, yeah. I'm still trying to convince him to mate the Blinken box with a Roomba, because then it could just randomly move around the Geek Gathering.
Cleaning well, as it goes.
Yeah. Sucking up detritus. There's your word for the day.
Detritus.
Sort of next up, I don't know if you guys saw this story, but, you know, for this, here's an idea for those of you who have younger kids. You know, I'm sort of in the, like, I should have done this. I think my son is trying to do it himself. But there is a man named Andy Bio, and he's a writer and technologist, and he thought it would be a good opportunity to do an experiment when he had a son. from his blog post on it, he says, quote, "I love games, and I genuinely wanted Elliot, his son, to love and appreciate them too, so here was my experiment. What happens when a 21st century kid plays through video game history in chronological order?" So he set his son up with, he started with arcade classics and the Atari 2600, from Asteroids to Zaxxon. After a year, they moved on to the 8-bit era with the NES and Sega classics. Next year, the SNES, Game Boy, and classic PC adventure games. Then the PlayStation and N64, Xbox and Game Boy Advance, and so on. They're going to keep doing that until they catch up with the modern era of gaming. Can you imagine?
That's crazy.
It's sort of brilliant and potentially cruel.
I don't think it's cruel. I think it's a cool idea.
It's going to be cruel when they get to the Sony Vita.
Well,
hey Jimmy, we're going to all get together and play play Gears of War on the network. And I'm sorry, I've got to play Donkey Kong through to the end.
I'm not there yet.
Excitebike.
I'm only up to 1987.
I'm playing cool games. Just ask your dad.
Looks like he's managed to work his way up through the Nintendo 64, somewhere around in there on the arc. Is
at least he's not making him. I guess he's not making him play every game. I'm sure it's sort of a curated list of games.
It's a tour of platforms, I think.
To do it, but you know, my son is into video gaming, and he's actually gone and bought on like eBay. He bought a Famicom, and he's bought some. He has some other platforms. The thing that's tough, and although he wants the actual real deal, because there's those units that'll play like just about every kind of old school cartridge there was, except I guess it's emulation, and he doesn't
MAME and stuff like that.
He doesn't want emulation. He wants the real deal. But it is interesting to see somebody going back to the Atari. I would think that's a tough. That's a tough sell when it's this blob is supposed to be your spaceship, and it's like, well, no, it looks more like eight squares with two squares kind of out at the corner.
I think the tough part is keeping him not being exposed to all the modern games, because if that's the first
thing
you saw,
right.
That's pretty awesome, you know. But if once he gets out there and if he accidentally sees like, oh wow, is that GTA? Like it might ruin the experience. It might ruin a lot of things if you were to see GTA.
No, we're gonna play combat now.
I was excited about Adventure when you can actually go through mazes.
Oh, yeah.
And you could the dragon, which didn't look like a dragon to me, looked like a dragon.
Looks
I was like, wow.
Like a seahorse.
There was a blue seahorse that floated around the walls, you know, and your little bitty large oversized pixel running on. But that was, I would get really excited when I was being chased through the dragon when I had the key, you know? Vivid.
One of the first video games I played was on an Apple II. And the thing that was amazing, it was in a computer lab at this school, and in one corner they had a green Tandy, you know, TRS-80 or whatever, or the earlier one, the green one with a green screen, that you could play some sort of golf game where you like told it what club you hit, and it told you how many yards it went. Mm-hmm. And then over on the other side of the room, the one that you like killed to have 5 minutes on, was playing Breakout in color. On the Apple II Plus, that had they actually had like paddles, you know, the paddle controllers and had it up on a TV set up in the corner. And just recently there was an interview with Woz about doing color, and he said he didn't 100% understand how it worked, but he made it work.
To do sounds
the
like,
color.
Sounds
so
like
do
Woz.
The color. It's like, a real I did this and I did that, and I fiddled around with it, and I got these colors. You know, and if I did this, I got this color, and if I did this, I got this other color. And, you know, I'm not 100% sure how it worked, but – and it's like – really, and you're executing that in hardware. It's like, oh wow, you know, you are the engineer's engineer.
Woz is like he's like the patron saint of modern hackery. You can't like computers and not like Woz. Even the most hardcore anti Apple crazies like gotta love Woz. Well, it's just such a great
guy. It's amazing how he got in the article. There were several kind of instances where he's just talking about what he was doing, and he's not got a big head about it, but.
No, he's really humble.
He grokked concepts that, you know, the rest of us, it was just jungle, you know, it was deep jungle, and these people threaded their way through it without any guides. We're coming along after basically all the jungle has been leveled, and they paved it, and it's a highway, and it's downhill, you know, so we come along, and they're like, they can explain it to us, and he was getting these concepts when basically nobody had any idea how you make this stuff work, and he had some thoughts about it, and he tried them out, and they worked.
There's a great website maintained by Andy Hertzfeld, one of the original Macintosh designers. He wrote a lot of the ROMs for the original Macintosh, worked at Apple, worked with Steve Jobs, worked with Burl Smith, the hardware designer of the Mac. Website's called folklore.org, and it's basically a collection of stories that Hertzfeld has brought together of his time developing the Mac. And there's a bunch of them focus around Steve Wozniak and some of the just amazing stuff that Steve Wozniak did. There's one in particular where he describes how Woz hacked together a card for the Apple II to add mouse support to it for the Apple II port of Mac Paint, which I think they called Apple Paint or something. I may be getting this wrong, but it's on the website, folklore.org. And basically, Woz had a very limited amount of time to put this together, and so he pulled a blank expansion card and slapped like two or three chips on it and did like some emergency math and was able to, because the problem was there wasn't enough power in the little 6502 running the Apple II to drive the mouse cursor and the display at the same time. But he did some kind of funky math, and it involved like using the horizontal blanking interval of the screen to like using that time to draw the mouse cursor. And the story's all in there. It's an amazing story, but it's just one of those like reasons why Woz is a genius. I know they had problems with the they had problems in the original Mac team trying to take the Apple II's disk controller to use during Mac development, because Woz had done the Apple II disk controller himself also, and it was one of those deals where like no one could understand how it worked, because he had like done it. Was like the hardware design came to him in a dream, and it was amazing, and it shouldn't have worked, but it did. Anyways, great guy, great website.
Didn't was it Park Xerox that Steve Jobs saw the mouse at originally and kind of lifted the idea from there?
Well, that was the idea, right? That was.
And then he called them a bunch of copier heads just to add insult to
it.
Injury.
Well, I mean, Xerox Park, I mean, this is probably the topic for another show, but yeah, they had the Palo Alto Research Center Xerox. They had all these amazing ideas, and you know, they had networked computers, they had graphical user interface, they had copying and pasting text at a time when no one else did.
They didn't really realize what they had.
Yeah, and that was the problem.
They didn't know how to monetize
it. Xerox management was bringing in folks from Microsoft and Apple and all these other technology companies to like tour through the research center and say, look at all these neat concepts that we're developing. And the people at the research center were like, we could sell this. You know, we could be selling this ourselves. And they're touring teams. And then, of course, you know, Microsoft and Apple both sort of independently at the same time both copied Xerox PARC, and that's what sort of led to the birth of the computer landscape as we know it today.
And don't forget Douglas Engelbart, and the mother of all demos.
The mother of all demos, the inventor of the mouse in 1968, 9, something like
69,
that.
69, I think, yeah.
It's a great YouTube video. It's pretty amazing.
A lot of it, you have to kind of concentrate, because a lot of it is fairly dull. But It is amazing the kind of things that you were seeing, because nobody had ever seen any of that before.
No, that's the thing. When you watch it, it looks like a demo from, you're like, when did they make to do this in like 1988 or something?
Right.
You're like, no, this was in 1969. They're doing this with a mouse.
And it was done remotely.
And it was done remotely. Yeah. Right. It is dull and it's kind of hard to understand and it's pretty dense, but so, it's like, oh my God, this is from 69. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So now we know how to one up the guy with the kid who's going through video game history. You have your child do computer history. You know, first they have to make an automated loom. Weave me a blanket, son.
Read this book on Babbage.
Before I'll let you take this wooden block.
You must construct a difference engine.
Mouse.
They have to, yeah, they're going to have to break the Enigma code. Rewin World War II for the Allies. Do we have a call?
All right, yes, we do.
Looks like we got Curtis on line one. Curtis, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, guys. I'm Curtis in Galveston.
How you doing, Curtis?
I'm all right. But I was listening to a previous caller, and it struck me that I need to call you and ask you about this question. I had an iPhone 5, really great, loved it and everything, but one day it went like dead. I plugged it in one night in the morning, it was like a brick. Took it to the store, and they put all these devices on it and everything, and it stayed a brick. So I bought an iPhone 6. And I thought, you know, that's cool. I got an iPhone 6. I went home that night, and I was at my desk, and I said, well, I'll just plug it into my computer and see what happens. And there was a brief flash. The little battery thing came up, and it had like a one-pixel red line at the end of it to show that, you know, it had no charge at all. And so I left it there overnight, and in the morning, it woke up. So I've got an iPhone 6 and an iPhone 5, which is cool. I got uses for the iPhone 5. But that's not my problem. My problem is when I'm sitting at my desk, and I've got the iPhone 5 at my desk, and I've got my iPhone 6, and I get a telephone call on my iPhone 6, my iPhone 5 rings.
Are these on your Wi-Fi network? They're both on your Wi-Fi network together?
They're both on my Wi-Fi network.
I think that you're getting the same effect. Nobody thought about it going phone to phone, but I think you're getting the same effect as our prior caller.
It's
which
Jim Thompson,
is,
yeah.
Had you updated the iPhone 5 to iOS 8.1?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Did you leave the old SIM in it?
Yes.
Take the SIM out.
Yeah.
Take the SIM out.
You know how to do that, right?
I did, and I tried to do that, but it didn't work.
What do you mean by it didn't work? What happened when
you tried? The little door didn't open when I stuck a paperclip into the hole.
Press harder. Really?
Yeah. Or else go to the store for whoever your provider is on your phone, and they can pop it.
Yeah.
And if you use a big paper clip, it actually may be too big. It may fit in the
tiny.
Yeah, it may fit in the hole, but it's not actually engaging the little mechanism. You may need to get, like, you could try, if you've got a safety pin, you could try that. Those generally work.
It's not really a problem, guys.
It sounds like a feature. Yeah. It sounds nice. Two phones?
Yeah, it's
especially how the billing's working out on that.
Leave one on each end of the house, and then you never have to worry about the phone being a far run from wherever you are.
Just don't tell AT&T. They'll probably figure out a way to charge you twice.
Yeah, I would check out the bill in case you're running, you know, two SIMs or two accounts on there. You never know.
Because they do watch that stuff. I had put a SIM card from a regular phone into a really old... I didn't think this counted as a smartphone, because all it was is it had a keyboard to text from for my youngest, and like immediately an hour later I got an email that said that AT&T had, as a courtesy, upgraded my account to a smartphone account for, you know, $35. So I was paying like iPhone rates for this ancient phone, this ancient hunk of plastic that just had a keyboard on it.
So they upgraded your bill too.
Yeah. Well,
exactly.
Well, I de-upgraded the phone immediately and called them and got that all straightened
really?
Out. Yes. But you got to be careful. You don't want to get to the end of the month and have twice the phone bill that you expected.
Mm-hmm. I'll watch for that.
Yeah, IRC agrees. It's definitely the old SIM.
Yeah, take it, get it out of there. All right. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Curtis.
Thanks, guys. Bye bye.
So what, you know, he mentioned carriers. T-Mobile did something really interesting this week with their It's called data, rollover data. Data stash.
They reinvented rollover.
They did. They've done rollover for data, which of course everybody who's on AT&T, you know, you had rollover minutes, right?
Right.
You, if you didn't use the minutes, and we always wanted that for data, and now T-Mobile is doing it.
That used to be. That was a Singular feature, wasn't it? That came that rollover minutes that came from Singular. Didn't
initially
it?
From Singular, yeah. Right? Right.
Yeah. And the only thing about the T-Mobile one that was disappointing to me as a T-Mobile customer is. You only get rollover data on data plans where you pay extra to have it. So you have to have 3 gigs of data per month or more. You get a gig for free with a smartphone.
You get 10 gig. They're giving everybody 10 gig in their stash to start.
If you get the rollover, I'm guessing.
Well, everybody gets a rollover that has 3 gig or more.
Right, and that's the one where you have to pay. You're paying extra per month to get the. To get that data, because you get, if you have a smartphone, you get, when I signed up, it was a gig. Now I think it's 2.5 gigs.
Well, they do, yeah, they do unlimited. So technically, I guess T-Mobile is unlimited data, but the issue is once you burn through a gig or two gigs, they limit you down. So you're on LTE or you're on, you know, nice, big fat pipe. I guess, is it LTE now for T-Mobile? Yeah. And they cap you down.
But if you don't have one that you pay extra per month, I mean, you're already paying for having
You're not paying extra. You just have to start at the 3 gig level.
Right, except the only way you get the 3 gig level is by paying a monthly fee.
Yeah,
right.
So I mean, you can buy up to 5 gigs.
An extra monthly fee.
Or 10 gigs.
So the deal is that the rollover thing, though, you would think that that would be for kind of all data because it's not like they're risking a lot. If you have a 1 gig plan, it's not like you're going to have.
You do get it with 1 gig on a tablet. So you can start at 1 gig on it if you got a data plan on a tablet.
But on a phone, they want
what started at 3.
All their things are tied to paying more on your phone bill. And yeah, you get data rollover, but you are like paying them more money than you would have.
Unless you
otherwise.
Already had the 3 gig.
Right, that's true.
Unless you already had the 3 gig. So on AT&T, I am on a four line family plan.
Uh-huh.
We started out with 10 gig, and we were periodically going over and having overages, and they started doing this thing where on other plans they were like offering, they would just bump it up, but they weren't doing the 10 gig plan, and I was getting like every time they'd have one of these things I get madder and madder. Finally they did the 10 gig plan, and so now we're still paying what we were paying for 10 gig, but we got 15, and that's just enough headroom for us that we feel much more comfortable now with that. Plus at the YMCA where I go and I watch my stories, they have upgraded the Wi-Fi at the YMCA.
That's gotta be nice.
So it's like a 20 megabyte down, and I can watch my stories on Wi-Fi now. so now I don't need all that extra data.
Now the cats can download whatever they want.
That's right. Yeah, data stash. That's the T-Mobile. It's very interesting. I like it.
It's because they're the Un-carrier.
Yeah, the Un-carrier was kind of an unsignal because if you go outside of Houston, you're kind of lost. Their signal doesn't do very well inside buildings, but they're upgrading that around the country, and probably very soon it'll be similar to AT&T.
Their marketing kind of makes me afraid to use all my data. That's a very
what does it say?
It looks like if you use the data, I'm going to get you with the back of the hand. It's an intimidating kind of look.
Yes, that's them trying to be edgy.
The other thing, though, that T-Mobile has for the building problem that only helps, obviously, if it's buildings that you're very familiar with or that you know, you're willing to connect up, is they do have where you can do calls over Wi-Fi
calling, right?
Which for at home, right. that's been wonderful for me.
So you have a T-Mobile phone?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a T-Mobile iPhone 6 here that I'm testing for that feature. In my apartment, I did the T-Mobile test drive where they did the thing where you could borrow it for week, right? And I couldn't use it in my apartment because I got zero signal. I could not make a call in my apartment.
Answers that question.
And so now it's great. If you have the 6 or the 6 Plus, you can get on the phone, you can start your call in the apartment, you can walk down the hall, and when it disconnects, it keeps going on the cellular network.
Can you tell when the handoff happens?
No. Huh? But nice. But if you have the iPhone 5C, which will still do it because iOS will do it, it isn't hardware supported, and so it drops.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do it, you're better off with the 6 on TV.
Well, I have an iPhone, plain iPhone 6 question, which is, are you getting better? How is your battery life on the just regular iPhone 6? Or is it better?
It's better
than
the 5. I had a 5.
Okay.
I end the day, let's see, what am I at now? I'm at 75%. That's pretty good. I would have been probably about 40% on the 5 at this point.
Cool. Okay, because I wondered. I knew the 6 Plus, obviously there's a lot more room to cram battery in, because I get about 4 days on one charge with the 6 Plus.
Yeah, the 6 Plus is like just a big battery.
Yeah. And where my 5S, often I needed, unless I was managing what I was using, I had to I charged it every day. You know, basically every evening I would charge it, or else I'd get partway through the day and be out of juice.
Barrett, what do you get on your?
I was about to say my Nexus 5, and I've got Lollipop on here now. My battery life is tanked. However, a couple of the guys that I work with also carry the exact same phone. They said they backed up everything off it, did a hard reset, and came in with fresh Lollipop, and it solved all the issues. So I have not yet had a chance to do that, but I'm curious as to whether it's going to happen. I'm having a hard time on some days making it through the day. And that's not being on my phone all the time. That's with Wi-Fi off. That's, and again, I'm working long days, but I should not have to find a charger before I get into 5 o'clock shadow. My phone should, you know, make it at least through there. We'll see. I'll report in January once I do the hardware reset, and we'll see. And that's assuming the phone makes it that long. But I'm not liking the Nexus 6, so I don't have a go-to phone right now.
What about the Moto X?
I was just about to say.
Yeah, I'm gonna go get my hands on some. To me, phone feel is more important than maker and a lot of that. And I can always make it vanilla just by throwing a ROM on there. But to me, the hardware is important. So I've been an HTC fan. I like the Moto stuff. Well, I was really excited about Motorola making, you know, the 6, but I'm just not liking it. So we'll see.
The X is a nice feeling phone. Dwight had his for a while. I mean, the G is not bad, honestly. The new G, it's bigger. It's probably about that big. And it's not, I mean, it doesn't feel plasticky and crappy. It feels nice.
I've always carried the straight from the Google Play Store Nexus flagship phone.
Right.
This will be the first time I've gotten away from that. So I like, you know, being the
but
first
the Moto
one
X
to get the updates.
So
like,
it's close to it.
It is, but you don't get the day one updates. You don't get to be like, haha, I've got Kit Kat or haha, I've got Lollipop before anyone else. And that's, you know, there's a little bit of perk to that. I like having it first. So I don't know if I want to give that
you
up
could,
yet.
You could go and find a OnePlus and go all crazy with Cyanogen that way.
Yeah, that's what I might wind up doing is if I can't find something that, you know, has not been tainted by the carriers, I'll just go with Cyanogen Mod or I'll go, you know, roll something myself.
Now, my son, I'll tell you what, uh-oh, there is another path.
Oh, no.
If you want instant
updates. I'm not
updates.
Ready for that talk yet. Although now that Dwight's touched my shoulder, it may be too late. The virus may be spreading.
You know, there's an update for this, everybody gets it.
And that's the whole, I don't like that democratization. I don't like to be in with everybody. I want to be.
You could.
I want to be that 1% of Android users that chose the correct phone and everyone else has slow stuff.
You could get a new BlackBerry Classic, the one that they just announced today. Classic.
There we go. Actually, the black phone sounded promising, but that doesn't look very funny. Then it's like you get the Boeing black phone, but that's only going out to government contractors and other NSA.
The HTC One M8 is a very nice phone, but it's not available in a clean version. It has the Sense UI. You'd have to.
You can get it with Windows Phone loaded on it now.
I think I have one.
Oh, you've
got HTC M8 with Windows Phone?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, oh, wait, no, I left it at home. But yeah, I like Windows 8.1.
I do too.
It's really nice.
The phone version, not the desktop one. Windows Phone 8.1.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. If I quit, I would use that before I would use Android. Which I think I've said on the show before. I'd rather use that than Android.
Ease of use or philosophical reasons, or were you attacked
really,
by an Android as a small
I
child?
Ease of use. I don't like Android. I've given it an honest go. I've settled with it and tried to use it for a month or so around.
Have you used Lollipop?
I have used it very, very briefly just to get the update installed and to click around and look at stuff. But I gave KitKat an honest go, and I just don't like it. I think it's cluttered. I think it's just a wreck of an operating system from a usability standpoint. Now I liked, I have a Nexus 4 that I own, and I threw Cyanogen on that without any of the Google Play stuff or without any of the Google packages that add all the stuff. So it was very, very bare.
So which phone did you have when you had the 4.0? Did you have Pure? Did you have like a Pure Android Pure from Google phone, or did you have a carrier?
It was the Nexus 4.
The Nexus 4. And you didn't like that?
Didn't like it. I thought it was still just like somebody just vomited applications all over it. I liked it with Cyanogen without any of the Google stuff. Mm-hmm. But at that point, you've got basically a smartphone with, I forget what the browser they use. It's Ice Weasel or something. Or you've got a very stripped browser. You can send and receive text messages. You can send and receive emails. If you have, I think you have offline calendaring, and you have and you can make phone calls, obviously. And that's like it. There's no app store. There's no nothing. And I actually kind of liked that. That was kind of neat. It's a very minimalist experience. But I mean, it's not really sustainable because it's a pain. And if you need to do anything with the phone, it gets to be kind of a pain.
It's so great until you need to do something.
Right. Oh. Until you have to actually use it.
So Dwight whips out, that's the 7, correct?
Yes. This is the Nexus 7. It has Lollipop on it.
I like the Nexus 7, and I will be the first to say that I thought they had the great idea with the 7-inch, and I'm glad that they got it first out.
Yes.
Before Apple.
Yes, I like it. Now, the thing is, one of the things that I have always thought about, battery's low, 1%. I don't know how long this will last.
That's all right. We only got 5 minutes, Dwight.
That's right. We do? Okay.
We do.
So one of the things I like that the setting screen always looked like very DOS to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, here, that looks like a modern mobile operating system.
6.0 got very flat, as it did, I think, with the iOS 2, the latest version of that. They went from, you know, 3D drop shadows, 90 glory, to very 2D kind of layouts. But I think it gets you a lot more real estate. You kind of get back.
All right, I'll put this away because I know you're...
Well, sadly, we are winding down to the kind of final minutes of the final show of the year for Technology Bites. You know, just to remind everybody before we do our final goodbyes, that there's no Technology Bites the next couple weeks. So Christmas Eve, don't ditch your family so that you can listen to to our show.
Technology Bites is in jail.
You can ditch your family and listen to Ray Hill if you want. That and we welcome you to do it. Just know that we're not on for the next couple weeks, and that we will be back. This isn't some kind of... This is just a our gift to you and us for the holidays, and then we'll be back. And that next Wednesday, I'm guessing that's the 6th, and then the Geek Gathering,
the 8th,
is the 8th or something like that. If the dates are wrong, I'm not one of those.
Afflicted will come back and set us straight, I'm sure.
And Jay will be back when we are back. I will be gone again, but I'll be at the Geek Gathering. And I hope you come out. I'd like to see you there.
There's new food at the Geek Gathering, too. There's an actual restaurant
next
door.
That's right. So. They were the last time I was there. I wasn't there last time, but I'm looking forward to coming there and having some tasty Mexican food.
All right. Well, I guess that's almost doing it for us,
Pete,
huh?
Yeah, I think we're about ready to wind it down. You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
I'm Dwight.
And Merry Christmas, and no, you'll have to look online. I had a version of Twas the Night Before Christmas that we didn't get to.
90.1 FM Houston.
All year long, KPFT offers stirring music, inspirational conversations, and radio that opens your mind and heart. While sharing the love this season, please don't forget about us. Just visit kpft.org anytime before the end of the year to donate. During the next few weeks, we want to offer you encouragement to remember all that KPFT gives you. Whether you listen every day or we're just your occasional refuge on your drive to work, we hope to only give you more as you give to us. From an enhanced schedule to fresh new programming, KPFT continues to grow through the support of listeners like you. 2015 presents many challenges and opportunities. Your gift at kpft.org will help share the programming you love with those who need it most. Just visit kpft.org now. Thanks. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Great music moves your heart and soul, and you can make a difference by donating something, whether it's moving or not. an old car, RV, motorcycle, tractor, or boat to KPFT's vehicle donation program as this year comes to a close. Since 1970, KPFT has moved your heart and soul with programming that matters to you. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org to help out now. Your tax-deductible donation before the new year gets you going, and it makes such a difference at the station that is the heart and soul of our community. So just move on over to the phone and call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org, and we'll make it easy to donate to the nonprofit radio station that you love. This is KPFT.